Hello, and welcome to another episode of Bloodhouse, the show where we talk about art house horror movies. I'm Joshua Conkle.
And I am your co-hostess with the mostest, Drusilla Adeline. How are you doing this week, Josh?
I'm good. Good. No complaints. Yeah, feeling great. How about you?
I'm good. My right arm is sore. I just got a really big Dracula tattoo down.
It looks so cool.
My right arm. It's the big ornate D from Andy Warhol's Dracula, and I'm in love with it. And I've had this in mind for like 5 years, and I didn't get my first tattoo until like a month ago. And now
I've got two.
Now I've got two. And one's
gigantic. I told you that would happen. I told you. your whole body's just going to be a coloring book now.
Everyone told me this would happen, and I was like, no, I like people with tattoos. I think tattoos are cool, but I don't know if I'm going to be that kind of person. And I got one very small one, and then I immediately booked an appointment for the
big one. It happens to everybody. It's addictive. Yeah. Surgery is the new sex. I texted Drusilla last night because yesterday David Cronenberg released a statement confirming that Crimes of the Future is a trans narrative, in part at least. And Drusilla was like, I knew it. And like, what terrific news to get while I'm mid tattoo.
Yeah, you sent me that and I opened up the video and played it while my tattoo artist was like leaning 2 inches from my face. Tattooing me, is she was like laughing at it while tattooing me.
Yeah,
we spent a lot of time during that session because it was like 5 hours or whatever talking about Crimes of the Future and talking about Cronenberg and talking about tattooing organs and talking about Frank Henenlotter movies. It was a blast.
Yeah, that sounds fun.
The greatest.
Yeah, tattoos aren't as painful as people say they are. I mean, you can kind of
Yeah, I think part of the reason why I was averse to them for years was because I was like, it's going to hurt. It's going to feel
bad.
And
it does hurt, but it's not like what I presume childbirth is like, or like.
Oh, yeah, no.
You know, like, it's terrible.
I don't think tattoos hurt. Me.
Oh, really?
Least. And this thing is fucking like 5 inches, maybe more. And it's a lot of blackout. It didn't hurt at all.
That's
it's
a like pretty easy
kind
place.
Of sore after, but
that's like a fatty part of the body, so it's a little bit easier. Like when I got tattoos on my wrists where there's less fat, that's more painful. But mostly tattoos, I think, hurt after you get them because it's sort of, if you don't have any listener, it's sort of like having a big rug burn. If you remember rug burns from you're a kid, it feels like that. It's like throbbing and raw and like open and yeah.
Well, you just have an open wound for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And there's nothing hotter.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't lick one like they do in David Cronenberg's Crash. But I think it's kind of hot to look at. I mean, I think like black eyes and scrapes and stuff like that are sexy too. One of my exes for like a birthday present for me had mugshots made of himself where he has like a black eye and a bloody lip because I think that's so sexy.
Yeah.
It's like giving me my version of a boudoir shot was him like having mugshots. Yeah.
I get that. I was talking with a friend last night after I got this and she was saying that her former roommate had a large tattoo on the inside of her arm and she called it her pussy getter.
Yeah.
Because women would just go up and grab it and be like, oh my God, this is such a great tattoo. And she'd be like, yep.
Yeah. There in the 2000s, there was this blog called Hot and Busted, which just like found hot guys mugshots, which is, you know, it was a meaner decade. We wouldn't do that maybe today, but I really liked that blog a lot.
The mid-2000s was a hell of a time to be around.
It was.
It was
the
truly the
was
wild
such a
west.
Dark. Yeah, it was so dark and mean, but in some ways, a lot of fun. Have you seen anything cool this week?
I saw something crazy cool this week. So my friend Danny dragged me on Wednesday to The Grove, the devil of Los Angeles, Rick Caruso's The Grove. On Wednesday, because Beyond Fest, our beloved Beyond Fest, was doing a one-time screening of S.S. Rajamouli's RRR.
I'm dying to see this.
Yeah. So, if you don't know, RRR is a new Bollywood action film about a fictitious revolutionary uprising in colonial India. It is 3 hours and change.
A musical, right? Because it's Bollywood.
It is, yeah, it's in part a musical, and it is also one of the single most homoerotic films I've seen in a long time. It is beautiful. If you just want to see two shirtless men in suspenders singing at each other, running around, throwing motorcycles and tigers at people, this movie is for you.
You said throwing motorcycles and tigers at people?
I did. I will repeat that. Throwing motorcycles and tigers at people.
How soon can I see this movie? Now, it's pronounced RRR and not RRR.
Yes.
Okay. It's,
I mean, yeah. It's
I wasn't
not like
sure. I truly
a
wasn't
Steve
sure.
Martin man with two brains kind of far kind of thing. It's I believe it stands for Rise, Roar, Revolt.
Got it.
And so the opening of the movie has a big title card that comes up and says the story, and the R is capitalized. Mm. And it gives you like the setup, and then the fire, and the R is capitalized, and introduces you to one of the main characters, and then the water, and the R is capitalized, and you're like, whoa, okay. All right, so that's where the three R's come from, right? And then 40 minutes into the movie, after this huge set piece happens, the two guys finally get together, and it's like insane. And then it goes R, 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 and the entire audience went batshit. The entire like last hour of this movie, this was in the biggest theater at the AMC at the Grove, which if you haven't been, is like opera seating. There's like box seating on the sides. It's huge. It's like two stories. It's like it's an IMAX screen. It was packed. It was sold out, and the entire last hour of the movie, everyone was on their feet and just screaming.
That's great.
And fitting for what we're going to be talking about in a little bit, there's a flogging scene, which is a public flogging scene, which is very long and drawn out, and half of the audience was squirming in their seats during it. Oh, it was a lot of fun. It was great.
Fun. That sounds great.
Yeah. Have you seen anything of wild note lately, Josh? Oh, yeah. Also, RRR is on Netflix.
Oh, it is. Okay, great.
I should say that. It's on Netflix. Yeah, get some friends over. Don't even find out what it's about. It's more fun to just jump in.
I can't wait.
Make some popcorn, have some drinks. Yep.
I did a deep dive on the director Penelope Spheeris, who, you know, mainstream audiences will know as the director of Wayne's World and lots of 90s studio comedies. Music fans will know her as the director of the punk trio of documentaries called The Decline of Western Civilization, which I'd seen many times and loved. But I'd never seen her like early narrative films. So I watched The Boys Next Door and Suburbia, both of which are really kind of like hard to watch, exploitative punk films from the early 80s. And if there's one thing I love after horror movies, it's juvenile delinquent films from the late 70s into the early 80s. And I had just never seen Suburbia, which I'd heard about my whole life. And it was really cool. I really enjoyed it. I liked Boys Next Door more, which stars Maxwell Caulfield from Grease 2 and Charlie Sheen as a queer-coded teenage couple on a murder spree through Los Angeles in the early 80s. And there's lots of queer-coded elements, also some pretty extreme homophobia. They do content warning beat a gay man to death. And there's some sexual assault. So there's like stuff that's hard to watch. And but I just loved it so much. I thought it was perfect. Whereas I felt like Suburbia had some rougher edges. Because Suburbia was produced by Roger Corman, and he made Penelope Spheris put in sex and or violence every 10 minutes. And so you really feel those touches where they kind of don't belong. But yeah, I really liked both of them. I did listen to an interview with Penelope Spheris where she said she regretted making Boys Next Door because she doesn't like to contribute to a culture of violence. And I was like, that's interesting. And I meant that in like a side eye way, because a lot of her movies do. And also like, who cares?
Yeah, fair.
But yeah, it was like a really interesting, great double feature.
I haven't seen The Boys Next Door.
Oh, it's great. It's really, really great. And Maxwell Caulfield is really good in it. Like, who knew he could act?
Well, I'm a gigantic Grease 2 fan.
I am too. I love Grease 2, but he's not good in it. And so when I mean, he's not. It's not a good movie. It's fun because it's bad.
Yeah.
And he certainly can't sing, and his acting chops aren't great in it. But apparently,
he just rolls up on a motorcycle, looks steamy, and that's all he needs to do for the whole
movie.
He's
incredibly hot in that movie. He's one of the most beautiful men who ever lived. But apparently, he channeled the failure of Grease 2 into his character for The Boys Next Door, is what he said in an interview. Truly, because he plays the more psychotic one, the sort of like ringleader of this murdersome duo. And he's like, I just channeled all of my anger from Grease 2 into this role because he didn't work for like 2 years after Grease 2. Oh,
Jesus.
It was such a public, you know, splashy flop.
But look what happened to Michelle Pfeiffer.
I know. What's the deal? I love Grease 2, so, you know, I'm Grease definitely so not much. Slandering the good name of Grease 2.
I have a pink Grease 2 bowling shirt.
Oh my God,
That has like Stephanie embroidered on it.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
You kind of have her style a little bit because you're a blonde who wears all black and you're skinny, you know what I mean? Like, you wear lots of skinny black jeans and black tops, and that's what she wears.
I mean, listen, if I could be Michelle Pfeiffer in any way, shape, and form, somewhere between that and Married to the Mob is the goal.
No one
with maybe a little bit of Catwoman through it.
I mean, Catwoman's pretty good. No one ever talks about how good blonde people look in all black.
Truly, it's the contrast.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's so great. We can pull it off because we're hot blondes in Los
Angeles. We're hot blondes.
But that's the suffers. We're in Los Angeles. It's so hard to wear good all black attire.
It's true. Okay, let's, no further ado, let's get into the movie of the day. This is a doozy, picked by our own Drusilla, from 1963, directed by Mario Bava, starring Christopher Lee and Dahlia Lavi. It's The Whip and the Body.
Faccio paura, eppure una volta ti piacevo.
Sì, una volta.
Ti è sempre piaciuta la violenza.
Yes. Okay. This is a very Drew pick if there ever was one.
Yes. Tell us why you picked this movie, why you like it, your history with it, all of that good stuff.
So The Whip and the Body is one of the more overlooked Mario Bava movies. It's not like the foundation of the giallo genre, like The Girl Who Knew Too Much or Blood and Black Lace. And it's not one of his splashier like Boris Karloff movies like Black Sabbath, and it's not, you know, one of the weirder genre things that he did like Danger Diabolique or Planet of the Vampires. It kind of like falls in between his other gothic movies, but the two things that it has going for it that those movies don't, I mean, it's gonna have all of the Mario Bava lighting that is like the reason to watch a Mario Bava movie is that it's going to be gorgeous and arch and insane.
Yeah.
This movie has two things that the others don't have in that stead, which is Christopher Lee basically playing Dracula.
Basically.
This movie is a ghost film, but it's also, I've commonly referred to it as my favorite Dracula film that's not based on Dracula.
Yeah, it feels like a vampire film, but isn't one at all in any sense.
This has like every hallmark of a vampire film, minus blood
vampires.
It's great. But so it has that, but then it also has very, very explicit sadomasochism.
Yes.
Like, way too explicit for the time BDSM.
Yeah, in the form of whipping, specifically.
Yeah, it's a lot of flogging, but Dahlia Lavi's performance sells that to a very lurid degree, to the point that I'm, every single time I watch this movie, I'm shocked that it was made in 1963 and released.
It did have some hurdles, which we'll get to.
Yeah. Oh my God.
In terms of being released.
So I got really, really into Mario Bava, as everyone does after getting into like Dario Argento and discovering giallo cinema and stuff like that. And I had tracked down a few of his movies, and, you know, they're not the easiest to get a hold of sometimes in the US because they're not always streaming or something like that. And there's different versions of some of them, which is very frustrating. But the American Cinematheque and the Egyptian Theater were doing a retrospective of his entire career at the Egyptian Theater in 2018, 2017, maybe?
Yeah, I went to Blood and Black Lace there.
Yeah. They did, they were all programmed as double bills, some as triple bills. They were all shown on film, except for a handful. I think Blood and Black Lace was a DCP of the new restoration. But I'd never seen this one. I'd always wanted to see this one because it's called The Whip and the Body, goddammit.
I know, it's such a good title.
And I think it was a part of a triple feature. I think with The Girl Who Knew Too Much and Bay of Blood, if I'm not mistaken. I'm pretty sure it was the second film in a triple feature. And I vividly remember the theater, like, emptying out after the first movie of people being like, we only wanted to come for one, whatever, and not a lot of people staying for The Whip and the Body. And I was alone in the Egyptian with like spatter. It's a big theater.
It's not really big, yeah.
There's only a handful of other people in the audience. Like a couple couples, a couple like odd like horror nuts in LA. And the movie played, and I was immediately enraptured, immediately drawn in. And as it was going on, I was like, I'm very glad that I saw this movie in theaters, because if I'd watched this at home, I would be pausing a lot for reasons.
Oh my gosh.
I would be Pee-wee Herming in this theater right now, and that's not a good idea. This movie is too, it's too much. It's like, it's a little too much. Yeah. I got kind of worked up watching this. And so I immediately bought a copy of it and have been trying to show it to friends for years.
I watched it twice this week, and I feel like I watched two different versions of it. Well, in fact, I know I did, because one, the opening credits were in French, were written in French. And the second time I watched it, they were in Italian, and both dubbed in English, of course, but I felt like the dubbing was different in both of them. So, yeah, there's a lot of different versions floating around out there.
How did you watch the two versions? Because I watched my Blu-ray last night with some friends, and the Kino Blu-ray opens with the French titles.
Yes, so I watched the Kino first, but I rented it, like, from Apple or something. And then the second time I watched it, it's part of a double feature on Prime with another old horror movie that I did not watch called She-Beast, maybe?
Oh, so it's like a public domain version.
Yes, and it was much, much worse. But I felt like after the first time I watched it, I felt like I was distracted and didn't give a close enough watch to do the episode. So I watched it a second time last night. Yeah, I guess I should do a synopsis of this. So it is a period piece. When it takes place, I could not tell you. But it's like, you know, old timey, 1800s, 1700s.
General Gothic times.
Yeah, sort of like Jane or Bronte, but like not in England, somewhere in Eastern Europe. So Christopher Lee plays Kurt Menliff, who is the son of a count, and he is the prodigal son who is returning to the castle after a long period of being disinherited, because sometime in the distant past, he had an affair with a servant who was so distraught that she took her own life. And so no one wants anything to do with them, and he's sort of been banished. He's coming back to the castle after many years away, ostensibly to congratulate his brother Cristiano on his recent marriage to Nivenka, who was once going to be his wife. But really, he wants to get in there and get his title back and his inheritance back. And at some
point, maybe get Nivenka back.
And maybe get Nivenka back, which brings me to his encounter with Nivenka on the beach, which is a sexual encounter in which he whips her with a horse bridle. And then that same night, he is murdered, seemingly by the curtains. It's a very weird death scene. And then seems to be again haunting the castle and its inhabitants. That's kind of the, without giving away any spoilers, that's kind of the synopsis, wouldn't you say? Or would you add anything?
Yeah, I mean, the general idea is this man is a bit of a cad.
He
has an S&M relationship with his brother's new wife, who I think he tells her, "You've always liked violence."
Yeah, he tells her
the English dub is not by Christopher Lee, it's by someone else.
Yeah.
So it kind of sounds like that. And she's very into him still. And then after he dies, you know, his ghost continues their games.
Yeah.
And that's the movie, basically.
Basically, it's very slight. And I don't mean that in a bad way. It just is a very simple movie with not a lot of layers beyond the top layer, which is fine.
Which we'll get into that because that was a choice.
Yeah. Well, maybe we should just get into that now. I mean, this movie, because of it came out in 1963, because of the S&M aspect, it was very heavily censored. What's the word for when you like take a movie, take the reels, and seized.
Yeah, it was seized by the Italian government.
Seized by the Italian government. They had to go to appeals. It was a very heavily edited version was released in the United States as what? Exclamation point, which is a title that I think is hilarious. It's so inappropriate for this movie. Like, what?
That's they
what
cut it, like 20 minutes out of the movie. They cut all the S&M out, so the movie made no sense. So I like to imagine whatever distributor got their hands on it were just like, "The fuck is this?" I don't know.
Maybe how
we'll call it title. What?
Yeah, what exclamation point? And the same version was released in the UK, but under the title "Night is the Phantom," which is
an amazing title.
it sounds like a title that was written by AI. Like it sounds good, but it doesn't actually make sense. Like if you spent 5 seconds with it, you're like, what? You're back to what? Exclamation point. it was very heavily censored, very heavily
the quote from the Italian government on the movie in October of 1963, because the film was charged with obscenity.
Right.
They declared that it contained, quote, "several sequences that refer to degenerations and anomalies of sexual life." and the court of Rome confiscated multiple scenes from the film that they described as contrary to morality.
Yeah.
The Italian government burned the posters for the movie. And they cut it down to 77 minutes.
I was wondering about that poster. I meant to look up how much it would cost to buy, if you could even buy an original poster, how much it would be, because I know a lot. I mean, you're somebody who collects horror posters, right? Like,
and I have a Mario Bava poster right behind me right now.
Yeah, Evil Eye.
Yeah, aka The Girl Who Knew Too Much, which is from like the year before. I mean, I've mostly run across German posters for this movie because I think France and Germany were the two countries that when it was first released in its full version, it went to France. It came out in Italy, France, and Germany, and then Italy like pulled it back immediately,
right?
And cut it down. But in France and Germany, it just played normally. And the German posters are amazing. And in German, the title is "The Woman and the Demon."
Oh, that's all right.
Yeah, it's pretty literal. It sounds cooler in German.
Yeah. Oh, I bet it sounds like much harsher and like
cool. And I domin. Yeah, like it's great. It's a beautiful language. And so most like if you're gonna buy a poster for it, you're probably gonna be able to get that. I think there's a few. It's probably easier to get your hold of like the Italian locandias, the like tall thin ones of it. But that was probably from the 1964 re-release because after the Italian government cut it down, they were allowed to release the film again. Heavily censored.
Got it.
And that's the one that was known for a long time. So, I mean, thankfully we have the full 92-minute version now.
Yeah, the Kino Lorber restoration was really beautiful.
The movie is stunning. The entire movie is bathed in blues and purples with sudden flashes of like greens and reds.
Definitely like what they called bisexual lighting a couple of years ago, because there was a lot of like one side of a person's face would be blue and the other side would be violet.
Well, it doesn't really have that like techno bisexual lighting of like Neon Demon and all of that stuff, which is very like post-80s. Yeah. This is like, I was watching this with friends last night because it's a movie to watch with friends.
Sure.
And like 2 minutes into it, a friend of mine described it as, this movie looks like a gothic romance cover brought to life.
Well, that's what it is. I mean, it really is a gothic novel filmed, and that's what I was looking for. I'm yes anding myself. It feels like a British horror movie because they were all period pieces, like a Hammer horror with more explicit sort of Italian elements, which is like the whipping and sort of like the knob on violence and sex turned up. That's just literally what it is.
I mean, the opening credits, because I mean, you talked about the fact that some of the versions that we both watched have like French opening credits.
Yeah.
But if you notice in any version of this movie, whether it's French or German or Italian or the English cut of it, all of the names of the crew in the opening credits are American names.
Yes, including Bava, who uses the pseudonym John M. Old.
Which is hilarious to
me. It's so good.
Because the idea behind that was that these Euro-Gothic horror films were so popular in the early 60s with the Hammer of Horror outings starring Christopher Lee.
Yeah.
And in America, with the Roger Corman AIP ones with Vincent Price. So The Pit and the Pendulum, The Haunted Palace, Fall of the House of Usher.
And this movie is in conversation with Pit and the Pendulum, since you mentioned it, because someone was like, I want you to make Pit and the Pendulum. And so that's sort of the roots of this.
Yeah, the producer showed the screenwriter, Ernesto Gastaldi, who we'll get into in a minute because he's very important, an Italian cut down version of Pit and the Pendulum. And it was like, we want to make one like this. And he was like, all right. And then Bava got a hold of it and made a completely different movie.
Yes.
But that's why all of the credits are in English, was they wanted to export it and trick people into thinking that this was a British or an American film.
Which is hilarious. Like, no one would ever be fooled.
No.
It feels so European.
Like, if you have watched Hammer horror films, like, if you did a triple bill of, like, Roger Corman's Fall of the House of Usher, and then, like, Horror of Dracula, and then Whipping the Body. Whipping the Body would stand out immediately as the outlier. Yes. Because the other ones are, like, very slow. They've got really pretty stylized lighting, but only sparsely. Only in the craziest scenes at the end. It's pretty, like, standard flat lighting, and it's a lot of, like, you got to find out what this is.
They're very stuffy as well.
They're very stuffy, and they got a lot of acclaim at the time for bringing sex and violence into these horror movies. But the sex was literally just, we're going to put these ladies in a tight corset and just heave their bosoms up, and you're going to see the top of that, and oh my God. And you're going to see a woman laying on a bed, biting the back of her hand, and oh my God, look at that. And maybe a little bit of blood will spray, and that's about it. Whipping the Body.
Yeah.
Is nearly a porn film by comparison.
Very lurid. Although, yes, it is. And of course, we've talked about how heavily censored it is. By today's standards, it's quite tame. Like, I would watch this with small children. No problem. You know what I mean?
You're going to fuck those kids up.
I don't think it's it's very explicit by today's standards. I thought it was quite innocent, actually.
It is quite innocent. And the other thing that we were comparing it to last night when we were watching it was 60 Scooby-Doo.
Yeah. I mean, I kept thinking of Dark Shadows, which is also just a take on gothic novels. You know, it has the crashing waves, the moody seaside. It has the castle on a cliff. It has secret passageways. It has candle. You know, it has like all of those tropey things.
It has
sleepwalking, like, you know, like.
Sleepwalking intentionally made muddy footprints.
Yeah.
Like. That are like perfect, every single one of them. You've got the like, there's a light shining from the crypt out there. What is it? What could it be?
Yeah.
And you have a woman collapsing by going, ah!
Yeah, a lot
at
of
the sight of anything.
I love the first scene in this movie, which is the housekeeper, Georgia. It's a dark and stormy night, of course. And she's looking at, so she has in a dome, she has the dagger that her daughter used to commit suicide prominently displayed. Like, it looks kind of like the rose from Disney's Beauty and the Beast, except it's a murder weapon.
It's propped up. There's blood still on it. And there's two roses at the base under the dome with it.
Yeah, so she's looking at this and sort of, and she's like, one, it was a night just like this that my daughter Tanya took her life with this knife, and one day it'll be used to kill Kurt Menliff in the same way. And then cut to Kurt Menliff like on horseback riding towards the castle. But she's just like, this is a woman who's just obsessed with avenging the suicide of her daughter. I thought that was so metal. Like, I want a murder weapon on display in my house.
Literally, you know what I mean? As soon as that scene started, my friend Ivory and I were like, oh my god, we need to make those. we need to have that shrine in our houses. Like,
it's so cool.
I want to recreate the suicide dagger from Whip in the Body just like for my friends. It's nuts. So many of this, because again, this entire movie is blue. Like, yes. This movie is blue.
When it's red.
Except when it's red.
Or purple.
Or green.
Yeah.
There's like one scene at the beginning where people are like on horseback at the beach that's like natural lighting. And it feels very jarring.
Yeah.
But so much of it looks like, I mean, it's very in vogue now. But there's whole Instagram accounts devoted to like the old Scooby-Doo backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And like matte paintings and stuff like that. And that's just what this movie looks like. Like, truly. These people are living in that. This is live action Scooby-Doo with BDSM.
Yeah.
It's amazing. I feel like in every scene when they're just like panning through an empty hallway with like three suits of armor just sitting in there, I'm like waiting. And even the music is super Scooby-Doo. I'm just waiting for like the lazy walk of Shaggy to come in with like triple-decker sandwich.
Yeah, the music kind of feels almost, it's so on the nose that it's like almost satirical of a gothic. Like, if I were going to make like a scary movie style version of a gothic novel, it would be music like this, which is good. I like it. Not a criticism.
This movie is like so cozy.
Yeah.
Like, I just want like a warm blanket and a hot cup of cider and Whip in the Body.
Yeah.
And I just want to like curl up with it because I want to live in this world. I want to have a fireplace in my bedroom that has a secret passage in it that I can lock at night so ghosts don't come in and kill me. Like, I love that. I want the ghost of my lover to come in at night and whip me into submission. Come on, guys. That's great.
I feel like if there was a version of my life where I saw this really young, it could be a comfort movie for me, the way that Bram Stoker's Dracula is, the way that Daughters of Darkness is. It kind of fits into that mold, I think.
It kind of has become that for me. It's like, if it's a Sunday morning and I'm feeling really crappy and I just don't want to get out of bed, the Whip in the Body is kind of like a go-to. Like, let's lay in bed a little bit longer. But also, okay, we need to talk about Dahlia Lavi's performance in this movie.
Yes.
So she is a Slavic Jewish actress. I think she's from Israel.
Now Palestine.
Now Palestine, yes.
Part of wherever. Whatever it was called then, it was called like British Israel. I don't know. It was a state that no longer exists. Now it's Palestine.
Yes.
But she is Jewish.
Yes, and she's and Slavic. And her character in Ivanka is supposed to be Slavic as well. And she's got the cheekbones to prove it. Yeah. She looks gorgeous. She is, every outfit she wears in this movie is like Elvira's wet dream.
Mm-hmm.
She intentionally has like a boob window dress near the end that you're like, I know what that's for. I know what's about to go in there. And almost all of her dresses are rigged to be like pulled off by a whip at a moment's notice. It's beautiful. But I think she's most well known for being in the Casino Royale parody film with Woody Allen and Peter Sellers.
Oh no.
Which is not very good, but it's also like a meh kind of comfort movie for me. And she's also in the Dean Martin James Bond spoof movie, the Matt Helm series. Hmm. She's in The Silencers.
Okay.
Which, you know, Sharon Tate would be in one of the sequels, and Margaret would be in one of the sequels. So she was in the first one, so good for her. She's just she was a hot girl who was in a lot of hot girl 60s movies.
Yeah.
But no one treated her better visually than Mario Bava.
She's beautiful in this.
In this. And she spends the entire movie wandering around like she's sleepwalking, even when she's like fully awake at the beginning. And laying in bed, looking terrified when Christopher Lee shows up. And then she very quickly just starts writhing on her bed, biting her wrist, biting a pillow, biting his hand, as we get some pretty, like, I mean, he's whipping her and you're seeing wounds build up on her body. And,
yeah.
Like, and she's like luridly like moaning. She
seems
into
to
it.
Like it. Yeah.
She's very into it. And the entire time Christopher Lee is telling her to submit to him because he knows that she only loves him. We will be together forever. Our love is eternal. All the vampire things.
Yeah. It feels like Christopher Lee is a little bit shortchanged in this. I mean, he's the top billing because he's ostensibly the draw here as a movie that's trying to pretending to be American or British. But he dies almost right away. And it's really her movie.
Yes.
He plays like the ghost that haunts the castle, but you don't get that much of him after he's dead. Is he wearing a wig in this? It looked very
She
strange.
Is. I don't know.
She definitely is.
She definitely is, but it looks great. It's fine. Well, when it's like down, it's like, I see the wig, honey. But when it's up, it looks great.
His hair is jet black, which is not his natural hair color. I don't know. And it looked like a wig sometimes. That's all.
I mean, it might be a wig. Yeah. Yeah, his curtain death scene.
It's which really weird.
It's kind of implied that like it's the ghost of Tanya, theoretically, because he is looking out the window, falls behind the curtain really fast. It's not like he falls off screen. It's like one curtain in the middle of the room that's just the width of his body, so no one else is there.
Yeah.
He gets caught up in it for a minute. A very, like, very goofy actor against curtain acting. It and then he comes dagger. Out of it with a knife in his neck.
And it is the dagger that killed Tanya.
Mm-hmm. It's somehow not in its case.
Yeah.
Which, and by then the way, he gives a very slow, very like on stage Hamlet kind of death.
Yeah.
He just
it reminded
slowly
me of...
falls down and looks at the dagger.
It reminded me of PJ Souls in Halloween, who always said that she just wanted to make her death last as long as possible so she could get more screen time. So when he's strangling her with the landline, she's like, even when she's like off screen. It reminded me of that. Also, I wanted to say, I think it's really funny when a character's name is Tanya instead of Tanya. Just reminds me of like an Australian movie or something. I guess maybe it's Muriel's Wedding. It just feels like inappropriate to the gothic movie. But
well, I just found it very funny that when they find Christopher Lee's body and they find the knife and the Tanya's mother, who is also one of the kind of housekeepers, immediately goes like, oh, this was Tanya's doing. I can tell immediately. And I'm like, his ankles are fine. That's not Tanya.
Yeah. You do get, once the murders start, you do get a some amount of like, did you do it? I think she did it. It's sort of like whodunit quality, but that's all superficial. I don't think we should spoil the movie, but it's also like, not that exciting.
Yeah, it's not
that.
It's
very slight.
Okay, so we're going to get into that aspect now and that part of production. So, before Mario Bava was even brought on, we were talking about how the producer showed the screenwriter Ernesto Gastaldi a version of Pit in the Pendulum and was told, just make that. So, for listeners who don't know, Ernesto Gastaldi is widely regarded as being kind of the author of the giallo boom. He was an incredibly prolific screenwriter in Italy. And if you watch any genre film from the like, from Italy, from like the like late 50s to like the early 80s, he probably wrote it under a pen name. And so a ton of the like iconic giallo films are written by him. Almost all of them. Tons of spaghetti westerns. And there's a motif that he would go back to again and again and again in giallo films because he was kind of obsessed with it and just couldn't get it just right. And it was because he had some thing for the Henri-Georges Clouzot movie Diabolique from 1955 with Simon Signoret, which is very much a like hysterical woman whodunit kind of movie.
Yeah.
Where like someone dies, are they coming back to life or not? Are other people dying? Am I going insane? Or is there a conspiracy of people trying to make me look insane or trying to kill me?
Right.
And that is something that he wrote into a ton of his giallo films and gothic horror films for Bava, for Sergio Martino, for Umberto Lenzi. And these are awesome movies. And that's why so many people talk about the giallo films being like, the endings make no sense because it's just someone being like, what is it? What's going on? Oh my God, he's dead. Now she's dead. I thought it was you the whole time. And then, my lover who I thought was dead from the beginning. You in league with my sister who you have a lesbian affair with. Oh my God. Like, it's always something like that.
Very soap opera.
Yeah. And it's very like, it always somehow is a con. It's always like two people in league to con someone out and like either drive them insane, get them to kill themselves or to kill them, make them look bad, get their inheritance money. It's always something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he wrote for Whip in the Body. Was he wrote a plot like that in a gothic setting like Edgar Allan Poe, and then he wove in some BDSM to get butts in seats.
Yeah.
And then Mario Bava took a look at the screenplay and was like, cool, I want to do this movie. I don't give two fucks about this, this con thing. I don't care if she's crazy, if they're making her crazy, or if there's actually a ghost. I don't give a fuck. I just want to light Christopher Lee. and I want to have some pretty blood and daggers and fire. That's all I care about. And so he cut a lot of that stuff out. And then also just didn't care about it. So the scenes where they'd like, you know, talk about, imply that like her new husband's cousin is in love with her new husband and
right. She
has feelings for him. And is she insane? Did you break into his room last night and slash his throat? Could it have been you? All of that stuff is still there. But you can tell that Bava doesn't give a fuck about it.
Right.
He only cares about the stuff between Dolly Lavi and Christopher Lee. And you know what? He's right to do so.
I don't know if he is. I mean, I like this movie. I know that the screenwriter was disappointed in it. I think this is a movie that you would say is style over substance. Again, for the thousandth time,
Style is substance.
Yeah, I don't mean that in a negative way. Style is substance. However, there's an alternative version of this movie that has a real story and deep characters. And Mario Bava wasn't interested in that, and that's fine. But I can understand, as a screenwriter, how infuriating it is when a director just ruins your movie.
Yeah, quote just unquote, like ruins your paves movie. Over paves all over of your plot with light.
Yeah. But I do like this movie a lot. Mario Bava, of course, is iconic and one of the godfathers of America, of horror, world horror. And yeah.
I mean, listen. Part of the reason that I'm kind of okay with the Gastaldi plot kind of being like wiped down. Again, there's still hints of it. Like, if you are like looking for that in the movie, you'll find it.
Yeah.
It is there. There is a question, like the movie ends kind of open-endedly on like, is she crazy? Is there really a ghost? Whatever. And you get a conclusion, but you don't know really what mm-hmm. was going on. And you can kind of infer from what you've seen. So like, there's enough there to get that plot across if that's what you're into. But my whole thing is like, Ernesto Gastaldi used that plot a lot, man.
Yes.
He used that plot a lot. It's in a lot of other gothic horror movies that he made. It's in a lot of other giallo movies that he made, like a lot, like almost every single one of them.
Yeah.
So you know what, man? It can get bulldozed by style sometimes. That's okay. We have it elsewhere.
Totally. And this is the movie that we have.
Yeah.
And so you can love it or not.
But there's no other movie, Bava aside, that looks like this and that like feels like this. Because Bava didn't do anything else like this ever.
I'm so glad that you said that, because that'll segue into a question that I had for you about this movie. If you were going to program a double feature with this movie, what would you program?
So, this is perfect timing because last night when I had friends over, I was pulling this movie off the shelf and then I found something else on my shelf that I had been meaning to watch. And I was like, oh, this would go super well with this. Let's watch this. And then everyone was like, we are tired, Drew. We're not watching two movies. And I was like, oh, but the other movie that I thought would be a great companion to this, granted, I haven't seen it yet. I really, really want to, okay. But it's also an Italian genre film. It's a little bit later that also deals with BDSM. It's not gothic. It's more of a giallo film, and it was directed by Elio Petri, who did Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion.
Okay.
And The Fifth Man, and he's like great, very, very, very political filmmaker. And he occasionally made some wild genre movies that he stuffed like Marxist politics into.
Ooh.
And this stars Vanessa Redgrave of The Devils,
mm-hmm.
and Franco Nero of Django and Carell fame.
Wow.
And it's called A Quiet Place in the Country.
I've never even heard of this. It sounds so good.
And the idea is that Franco Nero, Django, goes, he's like kind of doing the like hysterical woman trope of a lot of these movies, and he just needs to get away to the country. And that's when he runs into Vanessa Redgrave, who I believe is the former lover or something. I still haven't seen it yet. I really want to see it.
Yeah.
And she engages in fucking kinky BDSM games with him, but with her as the dominant.
Hmm.
I really want to watch this movie.
Yeah, that's
a friend
great.
Gave me a VHS tape of it years ago and was like, you're gonna love this movie. And I never got around to it. And then it was put on a Blu-ray by Scream Factory some time ago. And so I bought that and it's just been on my shelf forever. But I'm like, the two kinky Italian genre films.
Yeah.
One with, you know, a male dom, one with a femme dom. This seems ideal. The other one that I would program with this, which is probably a bit more well-known, is Lucio Fulci's The Devil's Honey.
Oh, yeah.
Which is from the 80s, and which is batshit bananas. I was talking with a friend about it recently, and she was saying that the, like, sex acts in that movie and the, like, implication of sex acts in that movie feels like Lucio Fulci has never been laid in his life. Because none of it makes any sense.
Yeah,
it's like people like licking up nail polish and like blowing saxophones into genitalia.
Yeah,
it's ridiculous. It's so much fun though.
I was thinking of a movie that feels like the grandchild of this movie. I know it must have been a reference for this movie, and I feel like this movie is one that you're going to roll your eyes at because it's rather mainstream. But I was thinking you could do this movie and then play Guillermo del Toro's Crimson Peak.
I'm not rolling my eyes at all. I knew you were going to say that, and I love that you're saying that.
Yeah. It feels like Crimson Peak, he must have seen this movie. I mean, the lighting, the primary colored lighting, the gothy tropiness of it. Mm-hmm. It just feels like a direct reference, although I would be curious to know if he had.
I love Del Toro. I'm certain he's seen this movie. I'm undoubtedly certain. And I know that he's a giant Mario Bava fan. And Crimson Peak is just his ode to Bava.
Yeah. Okay.
And Roger Corman and Hammer a little bit. But like, there's so much Mario Bava in that movie. It's insane. I mean, the same way that like Tim Burton made Sleepy Hollow just as his Mario Bava movie.
Yeah, I actually don't really like Del Toro, and Crimson Peak is the only one that I like. the only one that I like a lot and that I rewatch.
Crimson Peak is one of my favorites of his. It's absolutely top three for me, which is crazy because it's so underrated. People don't like that movie. And I don't know why. They're stupid.
I know why. And this is like when Haunting of Bly Manor came out, the second season of Mike Flanagan's show. People no longer are familiar with the tropes and trappings of gothic romance. They don't understand the genre. They're not familiar with it. And so they don't understand the reference of it. I think that's the biggest reason.
Yeah, it's a shame. Well, people love Bly Manor.
People don't love Bly Manor. People love Haunting of Hill House. People hate Bly Manor, which I thought was way better than Haunting of Hill House.
Well, I mostly hang out with lesbians, and they all love Bly Manor.
I loved Bly Manor, and I felt so about Haunting of Hill House, which is not the normal opinion.
I love Haunting of Hill House, but we'll talk about that more next week. Yeah. That'll come up for something else.
Well, listen, it's time to pivot, I think, to the game Have They Seen It, where we discuss and speculate wildly about whether notable figures have seen this feature. Do you have anyone, Drusilla?
I mean, I feel like I have two in mind. So we can start with the really obvious one.
Okay.
And because it's, you know, of this movie's ilk, and as a friend of one of the stars of this movie, I'm curious to know if Peter Cushing ever saw Whip in the Body, and what Peter Cushing thought of his good friend Chris Lee.
I think
whipping innocent maidens.
I think no, because I heard somewhere that Christopher Lee didn't like this movie.
Christopher Lee loves this movie.
Is that true? Okay,
yeah.
I got bad info.
Christopher Lee. So really quickly, Christopher Lee's dubbed by someone else.
Yeah.
In this movie, because this was one of his first Euro films outside of doing stuff in England, and he couldn't be bothered to hang around and do the dialogue for it.
Yeah.
And then when he saw it, which I assume that he saw The Night is the Phantom cut in England.
Probably, yeah.
Which was cut down and pretty well derided.
Yeah.
But apparently he said it was one of his favorite movies. Like, the final product was one of the favorite movies that he'd been a part of, and he wanted to work with Bava again, and that's when he did Hercules and the Haunted World.
Mm.
And so he, like, regretted not doing his voice for it because he liked it so much that all of the rest of the European films that he did in Italy and Germany, he went back and did his own dubbing.
Yeah, it turns out your voice is pretty important to your performance. In that case, I'll still say no. I don't know. It's my gut instinct. I feel like you know what I mean? Like, I have a lot of friends that are TV writers. It doesn't mean that I watch their show that they work on.
Yeah.
I have one for you. We've just talked about him. Do you think Mike Flanagan has seen this? Creator of Hill House and Bly Manor?
I think I like to imagine that, yes, Mike Flanagan has seen it. But I like to imagine that while he was prepping for Haunting of Hill House, that his wife, the great actress who plays many characters in his shows, she plays
Theo.
Theo, yeah. I like to imagine that Mike Flanagan and his wife, Kate Siegel, who plays, you know, Theo, and she's also like basically the lead in Midnight Mass.
Mm-hmm.
I like to imagine that he was like, yeah, I'm going to do prep work for our new ghost show. Let's watch this old ghost movie together. And like midway through, she was like, nope, no, 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 no. I see what you're doing, Mike. Stop it. But yeah, I like to imagine he's seen. I hope. I mean, it's one of those things that when I watch something that resonates and that resonates with a genre, particularly,
yeah,
and that there's something that, you know, you see that's contemporary that is playing in that genre, I hope that the people that are making it are also having a similar thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember being a teenager and finding like Costa Gavras movies and like Z and Battle of Algiers for the first time, mm-hmm. and I just remember being like, I hope Anti-Flag have seen these movies. Feel like they like this. Yeah. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Mm. So I like to imagine. You know what? I feel like it wouldn't be hard to get to the bottom of that answer.
Probably not.
But we can probably assess it. And you know what, Mike, if you're listening and you haven't seen it, you're more than welcome to come over. It's playing on a loop in my house for the next week. we'll gladly show you The Whip of the Body. I think you're really going to dig it, man. So the one that I'm thinking of,
do you want me to go?
Okay. No. Trust me, I have it. So Josh and I have been texting a lot about Crimes of the Future lately because we are big Cronin nuts. And an article was written recently.
Oh my God, I know where you're going with this. Go on.
Deriding it, saying it was trash and it was exploitation, it was awful, it was so bad. And it was written by famed film critic and evil homosexual Rex Reed. Unfortunately, star of one of my favorite movies, Myra Breckinridge.
Oh my God, is he the star of Myra Breckinridge?
Not the star. He's Myron Breckinridge. So he's like a pre-transition Myra Breckinridge.
Oh my gosh, I haven't seen that in so long.
Oh, it's the most unfortunate thing about the movie because the movie is amazing.
Yeah, I loved the movie when I saw it.
God, Raquel Welch as a trans woman who is like bi and obsessed with old Hollywood. Why do I relate to that so much? Anyway, Rex Reed sucks. And he not sucks. In like the like fun, hot way. He's just awful.
I feel like I want to say...
Do you think Rex Reed saw The Whip and the Body? Or in the 60s as what?
What? Exclamation point. Possibly. I don't know if it's one that that would really stick with him. It is like sort of a lesser Bava. Mm-hmm. So I feel like maybe he would have seen like Black Sunday or Blood and Black Lace. I don't know if he would have gotten to this one. But I feel like my answer is no, but I don't really have a good sense of why other than it's like not top shelf Bava for most people.
I feel like somewhere in a landfill in New York City, there is an unprinted Village Voice write up on this movie by Rex Reed that he just got so angry and upset that the only things that he could write about this just couldn't be published. And it's like, yeah, you wrote two sentences that this movie's just bad, 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 bad. No, Rex, you can't publish this.
Rex Reed makes me homophobic.
Same. Same. He makes me want to use the F slur, which I will say for myself.
Yeah, I use that word all the time in the privacy of my own home.
Same.
Or Michael Kennedy, friend of the pod, will text me someone's bad tweet and be like, this F slur. That's it.
Like, I mean, I think that's how I responded to your Rex Reed thing when you sent it to me the other day.
I have somebody for you. This is a fun one. I don't know my feminism waves that well. I think she's second wave feminist. Andrea Dworkin, famous anti-pornography feminist from the 70s famous feminist who was virulently against pornography.
As a feminist, I kind of hate second wave feminism a lot.
Yeah, I think most people do nowadays.
Yeah, it's part of the reason why I really hate Fran Lebowitz. Turfy piece of
her.
Shit.
Wait, she's a TERF?
She's a TERF.
What?
Yes.
Fuck!
Fran Lebowitz is a transphobe.
I had no idea. I just love her. I've always loved her grumpiness, even when I didn't agree with her. But oh man, that's
Fran Lebowitz is a bigoted transphobe.
Fuck, that sucks. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, I think Andrew Dworkin, not a fan of Whip in the Body. I think there's. I doubt she even heard of it when it came out. I'm sure she was just in general anti all of those exploitative drive-in movies that the teens are going to today. And if someone came up to her and was like, have you heard about what? The one where they just like whip that woman and she's really into it. She would have been like, in my American screens, they're letting an Italian beauty be abused by specters and spooks.
I love your Andrea Dworkin impression.
I've never heard her voice. That's what I imagine it sounds like.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's the sound of pearl clutching, I assume.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, listen, when there's a stick that far up your ass, it's hard to enjoy whipping.
Yep.
It's just dangerous. You shouldn't do it.
On that note, I think that's all the time we have for this episode of Bloodhouse. If you like this show, please rate it on all the things. Drusilla, where can people follow you?
You can find me over at sisterhydedesign.com or over on Instagram at HydeSister or over on Letterboxd, probably the same, Drusilla Adeline, over there where I can leave scathing reviews calling Rex Reed awful names. What about you, Josh?
Joshua Conkle on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd. And what are we watching next week, Drusilla?
Next week, we are taking all our cute little ghosties from this movie and making them very real and getting a whole lot more scary down under with Lake Mungo.
Ooh, ciao, ciao.